Welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa. I'm your host. And in today's episode, I'm speaking with performance dietitian Dane Baker. He works at Axis Sports Medicine and collaborates with the New Zealand Warriors and the University of Otago. Dane and I spoke about all things protein and relative energy deficiency in sports, aka REDS. If you like the show, please subscribe and give us a rating or share the episode with someone who might find it helpful. Thank you so much. And as always, if you want help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we are your go-to coaches. Just hit the contact link in the show notes. Now onto my conversation with Dane. Dane Baker, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm really, really excited to talk about all things protein and all things REDS today. Before we dive into that, though, I would just like to hear from you. What are you excited for the listener to learn today?
Yeah, hopefully I can give, a practical insight into working with athletes and patients and trying to get the best out of their health and performance through nutrition.
Lovely. I think that's a really great goal to have, and I'm sure the listeners are interested in hearing the practical application for themselves as well. So before we get into the theory of it all, I would like to hear a little bit about you as well. So maybe you can give us a bit of your background story and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so I'm a sports dietitian. So I studied at the University of Otago, and since then I've worked in a range of sort of different roles. So I worked initially clinically as a diabetes dietitian, sort of many years ago, and then from there I've sort of been immersed in sports nutrition for the last 15 years. I worked in New Zealand, so we have our High Performance Sport New Zealand, which is sort of like our Olympic program, and I worked there for 10 years, just finishing up at sort of the end of 2021. And during that time, I also worked quite closely with professional rugby. So in New Zealand, we have Super Rugby. So I worked with Chiefs Super Rugby team for almost 9 seasons, the Blues, and the female, the women's sevens team. So they're called the Black Firm Sevens. So they were gold medalists at the Tokyo and Paris Games, and also a silver at the Rio Games. So those were teams that were quite close to my heart where I worked. And then in recent times, I've sort of moved more into sort of private work. So I work at Axis Sports Medicine. So there I work with a range of all sorts of patients of all walks of life. We have a dedicated REDS clinic. So we see a lot of specific REDS referrals from our multidisciplinary team. And I also work as a researcher and lecturer at the University of Otago. So that's where most of my time is spent between those two roles. And I also do coach education for high performance sport. So we, about every 6 weeks, we're around the country educating coaches around nutrition and physiology.
Super cool. It sounds like you definitely get bored, I would say. And I think even though you mostly work or worked with high performance athletes, there are so many things we as in like general population that just likes to get the most out of their health and body can really look up to what the people in high performance are doing very often. So I'm excited to hear more about that. And you've already mentioned REDS, and I in the introduction also mentioned REDS. And to start off with, I would just like to kind of give the listeners a proper definition of what it really is, because it also had a bit of a name change over the course of the years.
Yeah.
Please tell us, what is REDS?
Yeah, so REDS stands for Relative Energy Deficiency in Sport. It has changed names over recent years. So initially there was a dash in the red, so people termed it REDS. In 2023, the authors were very keen to reframe that to be called REDS. I guess it has its origins, if you think back to sort of the late 90s, early 2000s, the term female athlete triad. And since then, its evolution has been towards the term relative energy deficiency in sport. And that was around 2014 when that sort of consensus came out. So its origins really comes from the concept of low energy availability, which is essentially as a chronic sort of energy shortage, which then starts to impact a range of different systems in the body. So that can be the reproductive system, the bone, the brain, the heart, the metabolism, iron, lipids, a lot of systems can be impacted. And I guess over the last 20 years, the research has evolved to understand that it affects a range of different systems. It also affects males and females. And so that's where the sort of terminology has sort of evolved as the research has evolved. But yeah, a really interesting area, and an area that unfortunately impacts a lot of patients or a lot of individuals around the world.
Yeah, the first time I kind of became aware of it was more when it was called Female Athlete Triad. And I think at that time I sort of heard more about it through the lens of female athletes not having their cycle or maybe being more prone to injury in the sense of fractures, etc. And then I think those are only really the tips of the iceberg. And as you said, we have since learned that obviously, energy deficiency also leads to some sort of negative aspects in males as well. So I'm really happy that we're kind of reframing that and bringing a wider picture to that, making sure that, hey, it's first of all, it's not just high performance athletes. The amount of people that I work with, or even where I personally have also been, where it's like you love doing sports, you love being active, maybe you are just either eating super clean, you might not even be consciously trying to diet, but like eating too clean, so to speak, having a hard time getting all your food in because you also have a busy life, or you're actually consciously putting yourself in like a bit of a deficiency because you have some sort of disordered eating patterns and then not really making up for things. Or maybe you're even just like training for something really hard, let's say an ultra, where the energy need is just so high. And if you are not aware of the need for that energy intake, maybe you're just keeping on eating how you used to eat, and that's no longer sufficient. So yeah, I mean, you mentioned some possible ways in which that can show up, but maybe we can kind of walk through the people that you work with, like what are their main symptoms, and are they usually aware of the fact that they might not be getting enough energy in for their activity level?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So I think if we so start at the beginning to your earlier point, absolutely. I think it's important to know that everyone can be impacted by low energy availability. And the research has always suggested that the rates of sort of REDS or low energy availability is often more prevalent in recreational athletes than elite. So often elite athletes will have a bigger support network of sort of physicians and expert help that will hopefully pick things up a bit earlier. We unfortunately, our sort of, whatever we term the term recreational athlete, which can be a very serious athlete without that elite support, can go for longer without that sort of follow-up or that checking in. And so, yeah, and the challenge that we have is if there are prolonged periods of low energy availability, and the term we sort of use now is problematic, then one of the first things that can become a real problem is bone health. So often in our clinic, the first presentation might be for a stress fracture. So I work in a sports medicine clinic, and we have sports physicians that will typically, that can be one of the first signs once we dive a bit deeper. But we can also obviously have a fatigued and tired athlete arrive. And part of that, I guess, clinical workup is identifying all other factors that may be causing that. And then if there is a high risk for low energy, that would be something that I would be working on with the athlete to try to optimize. And it's awesome being in a multidisciplinary clinic where we have reproductive endocrinologists, sports physicians that really do a lot of that high-end clinical workup. And it allows myself to really work on the nutrition side of things. But the patient or the athlete has a really good understanding of what we're trying to do. But yeah, probably for presentation is there's more awareness now, I think, for females around irregularities in menstrual cycles. So that's great. So we're seeing that being a reason to present. We do a lot of work with GPs who are often the first port of call for patients around the what that looks like and where to refer on. Also we can have injuries, fatigue, tiredness, and just training maladaptation. So all of these can be multifactorial, but that's why we have expert physicians that can work through that.
Yeah, I think that actually makes a lot of sense in regards to it being even more prevalent in recreational athletes, because I do think often in recreational aspects, the drive to also see aesthetic results or to be lean all the time is perhaps higher than someone who's just like really focused on performing really well. And, they might be more intuitive in the sense of, oh, I'm hungrier, I'm going to eat more, as opposed to someone who's like really trying to stay shredded 365 d days of the year.
And that's interesting because a lot of the early work focused on and female athlete tried in the early 90s around there was a lot of a really high prevalence of amenorrhea and stress fractures, and that was the first sort of putting all the fit pieces together. And a lot of the early work was done in those aesthetic sports or weight restricted sports. But now we've seen the evolution of the research, and in a term we use is sort of inadvertent underfueling, which a lot of athletes with the best intentions can just still get it wrong because there's such high energy expenditure, there's lack of awareness. We also see with athletes, it's really common that appetite doesn't track with training volume. So we see athletes sometimes fueling less when the training increases. And all of those things can be reasons why problematic low energy availability can occur.
Yeah, I think that makes absolute sense. And I'm curious, with the people that you work with, do you usually have them track their food in the sense of weighing food out to actually see like how low their intake is? Do you put them in a metabolic ward chamber? I mean, that would probably be ideal scenario. I don't think that's always practical.
So that's a good question because part of the challenge that we have and that we're looking a lot at the moment for our research is the clinical application of this. So we work in a clinical health setting where a lot of this isn't funded by government. So it's often a user pays, it's private health insurance, and the applicability to do metabolic testing in clinic is just not possible. As far as tracking goes, one of the challenges that we have, or one of the things we try to really prioritize is our clinical assessment. So with this sort of diagnosis, or when we have a patient with at risk of low energy, one of the things that's always front of mind is a potential sort of restricted eating pattern, disordered eating. There's always, I guess, a spectrum of that. So we know that tracking food, there's a high level of error, and that can cause anxiety in some patients. So a tool that we use is, which is completely optional for the patient, is a photo journal. So they can simply put photos into the journal. It's completely private to myself for the assessment. We'll go through a full diet history, but we can use those images to try to get an understanding of portion size and style of food without causing the anxiety, I guess, of tracking. And we also know that if someone does provide a tracked diet, there is limitations in assessing that. And so that can also, cause more, not distraction, but it can cause error in the consultation. And the way we try to work is understanding what they're doing. And we know these sort of energy thresholds, and we're ultimately trying to just work up the chain a little bit with those energy thresholds and monitor reproductive function and try to restore energy balance and a normal reproductive profile.
Yeah, it's so difficult to determine the right tool. I can imagine, because I mean, in my opinion, there's high value to at some point weighing out your food and tracking your food, because you become aware what are foods that are high in protein or what is energy dense and what isn't. But as you mentioned, if there is already a disordered eating pattern present, that can be a fine line. And I guess likewise, I don't know how you see that, but how do you get how do you assess their energy output? Do you use wearables such as Apple Watch, etc., to see how much they're actually quote unquote burning? Or what do you use there?
So again, we're limited with our clinical setting of often having a patient in front of us for an hour and trying to get through all this information. So I'll do a full review of their weekly training schedule or activity patterns. So I will use, if they do have any wearable data, that will definitely be part of it. Often we have patients sending through training sessions later on, so I can incorporate those. We'll also try to get an understanding of the intensity, the duration, and the type of the session. And so I can also use a lot of metabolic equivalents to just get a rough understanding. And this is all an art rather than a science because we know there's limitations in that. But a big thing we've found is trying to get the patient to buy into ultimately increasing their energy availability. So we've found, similar to what you're saying in some regards, is the more scientific we make it, the more positive feedback we get from those patients around, okay, rather than me just saying, go away and eat more because I think you need to eat more. Here's my reasoning for this. And a big thing with athletes is fueling the work that they need. So what they're doing on different days will change, and fueling patterns will change between morning or afternoon sessions. So ultimately, it's a periodized nutrition plan, but that they understand how energy availability is part of that.
Absolutely. Knowledge is so power when it comes to execution, when it comes to adherence. I couldn't agree more. And I'm wondering when you do make these increases, because I mean, a lot of that is mental, and particularly if somebody is consciously or subconsciously restricting because of fear of gaining weight. Where do you start? Do you begin like how much of a junk, you can probably not just say like, oh, let's add an extra whole meal because you're like way low. What are some strategies, and do you increase through carbs or fats or both? Where do we start?
Yeah, so we have found we've just sort of published research on trying to review patients that have gone through the process, so a retrospective survey. And one of the things we found was, which is quite obvious, is that the biggest level of anxiety around making the change was around potential weight gain. But also with that, we found that the increasing energy intake was the biggest thing that the athlete or the patient changed. And we put that back to this sort of light bulb moment that we're seeing a bit in the research of REDS, where that education and awareness around what is low energy availability, how it's impacting their body, that's a real key part of the education and the consult to get them to sort of buy into the process. Okay, this is where we are. This is where we think the energy availability is optimized for you. And how do we get there? And then it's a process of, there's always a few rules that we're looking at through the research is, energy distribution is probably a key thing, and we've learned that we want to distribute our energy evenly across the day. Within that energy, we then want to optimize carbohydrate availability depending on the type of exercise that they're doing. And so that might mean fueling before training. If the session's hard enough, we're fueling during. We're paying close attention to energy content in meals and meal preparation and of working towards a balance. And there will be certain sessions that are, very easy that might not require much carbohydrate availability, but we're sort of targeting those. So it's definitely not, here's a supplement, take this bar and everything's fixed. It's thinking about their diet as a whole. And a lot of our patients are doing a great job, and we're not there to turn their diet upside down. We're like, okay, here's the little optimization that will help, because that's all part of getting, making change and getting the patient to buy into that.
I think starting around the training window is a really, really great point, because that's, I could imagine that's a point where they see the best results quite quickly, and also where the body utilizes that extra fuel the best, obviously. And I mean, just meeting the person where they are is, I think, absolutely key. As you mentioned, if it's someone who is struggling with sleep, and getting them to eat a little bit more before bedtime, and right away they sleep better, it's like, oh cool, I'm buying in, I'm doing everything that Dane's telling me. Or someone wants to have a child at some point and they have lost their cycle, and you're just continuing to think, get them to think of their why, and having those bigger drivers. I think that's a really key point. So yeah, I love that. I would love to just, like, for the listener, if someone is thinking, I don't know if that applies, I might not have a cycle, or I'm sleeping a little bit irregularly, I do think I'm eating enough, but maybe not. I could imagine that gray zone, that person that's not really under eating of like 1200 calories, whether they might just be like in and out of maintenance, not really making too much progress with their performance though, that's probably the most dangerous zone almost, because we're kind of under fueling consistently, where it's not as noticeable.
Yep, absolutely. And it is a challenging area because with every calculation, you can't take into effect previous sort of metabolic adaptation of the previous. We have patients that may be amenorrheic for 18 months, and we know that there's significant sort of metabolic impacts of that. So, yeah, again, there's a lot of art in this and trying. I mean, our ultimate goal for our patients is to restore a regular menstrual cycle and optimize their reproductive profile. And it might be as simple as the classical sort of formulas that we know around energy availability and those thresholds. Some it might just be a small lift. And in some patients, it's as simple as just a bit more distribution of that energy. So those are all the things we're looking at. But ultimately, it's there's always an individual response, and we're learning a lot around all the other factors that can impact the reproductive system, like stress, psychological stress, training stress, sleep. So there's a lot of other factors, and that's something that the physician takes works very closely with. So there could be a big psychological element that's a key part of this, and so we want to make sure that that's addressed, as well as just as a baseline trying to optimize their energy availability.
I'm curious with regards to osteoporosis. Do you get your clients to do some kind of test, like a DEXA scan or something like that? Is that available to a lot of people in New Zealand?
So that would be something that's referred by the physician. And so in New Zealand, it does differ compared to overseas. Our availability for scans, I would say, is a bit more limited than it seems to be in the US. But there would be reasons such as, like, if there's concern around bone density, if there's been, typically for our younger athletes, if there's been one or two stress fractures, that would be a reason for a bone scan. And that can be confronting for some patients. It can be positive for others if we've still got time to build some bone density. So if we can pick it up in adolescence early, we've got a 2 or 3 year window sometimes to help. In our sort of menopause patients, where we have got some real challenges, that's a challenging patient, and we are seeing more of that. And I think the endocrinologists and sports surgeons are concerned that we do have a potential big increase coming at us around osteoporosis. But we are seeing positive impacts from, exercise interventions, protein, calcium, energy availability, all of these things.
Yeah, really good
And
point. Yeah, I agree. The more data we have, the sooner the better. But like, for example, I'm originally from Germany, and it's near impossible as like just a general population person without any specific reason to get a DEXA scan. And now I live in South America, even less likely to be able to get one over here. But yeah, data is certainly power. I want to shift gears a little bit because, as I mentioned in the introduction, you are also very passionate about protein, and we just hinted at protein. So I am. Would like to hear from you, not just for athletes, but for really anybody who is interested in physique enhancement, interested in longevity and overall health. What are your recommendations when it comes to protein quantity? Because there are so many debates about that in the sense of, what does the government recommend at 0.6 or whatever per kilogram? And then, of course, athletes eating up to, I don't know, 4 grams per pound of ki per kilogram. What do you as an expert recommend?
So first, I just a caution. I'm not a protein researcher. I guess I follow the field and follow researchers in that space. And it's something that commonly comes up with patients and athletes. And when we talk to undergrad students, I guess it's the key thing now is with social media, we're seeing obviously so much more influence around protein, and it seems to be that in the fad, not the fad, but the popular macronutrient at the moment. I guess probably my take home at the moment is we definitely know that protein intake needs to be increased from those RDAs, and I think that's quite obvious. I guess the challenge or the debate at the moment is, do we need those higher doses of, I guess you've got a lot of the protein researchers talking about 1.2 to 1.6 and then grams per kilo. And then I think at the moment, from the research we have, we see sort of diminishing returns from 1.6 to 2 grams. But potentially, if you want to throw the kitchen sink at protein, I think going to that 2 grams is probably a good thing. But I think we just don't have the research at the moment to show the benefits of going above that. And I know there's lots of discussion around the sort of the increase potentially. We know physique athletes will increase that during times of competition prep, and that's just not an area that I work in. But I do follow that work, and it's yeah. I mean the volume of resistance training is a different beast than what we see with our typical population. I think one of the challenges we have at the moment is there's a lot of debate around 1.6 to 2, but we know that so many female patients in particular are not anywhere near that sort of 1.2 to 1.6. So I think increasing protein towards those levels is beneficial. The female athlete and the proposed sort of luteal bump in protein, I think there's a lot of discussion around that, and I think at the moment we just don't have the randomized control trials to have a lot of confidence in saying that. However, I do think the message of optimizing your protein is definitely really important for female athletes. And hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll get a bit more insight into this. I'm a big believer in sort of, I guess I follow a lot of the work of Stu Phillips and Luke Van Loon around. I think the biggest take-home message is probably getting enough protein in your day. If you can distribute that, I think distribution is really important for appetite control when we work with a lot of our weight loss athletes or patients. And just eating good high quality protein is important. So consistency across the day, working towards, good quality protein with each meal and snack. And yeah, I guess that's a long-winded answer, but it's a challenging one.
Yeah, I think the funny thing really is that the debate is kind of between the two extremes, the general population who really on average is not getting enough, a male of 200 pounds or whatever eating 70 grams per day sort of thing, or the female eating 50 grams per day. And then on the other end of the spectrum, many people that are interested in hypertrophy or physique enhancement, whether that be competitors or just lifestyle athletes, who naturally almost overeat on protein. And it's kind of like, oh, we're talking about which one is right, but let's just find the middle. And yeah, why not aim for like a pound, a gram per pound, and make it quote unquote easy. But I mean, especially also to the point of like osteoporosis or older major population and athletes, I think that that's often, as you mentioned, with menopausal clients or patients, where we are seeing a lack, and where I do think a benefit comes in by increasing that beyond the 1.6 grams per kilo or so as well, potentially.
I think one of the things that we're seeing patients struggle with is, I've seen this just in the last few weeks with our older female patients, is they're quite confused at the moment, and they are seeing recommendations that are just not possible to consume, and they feel like, and those are those really high, we're going right towards the 2.5, 3 grams, and I think that's, so it's just going, okay, the biggest lever we can pull is resistance training. The potential extra 20% is coming from optimizing that protein intake. So let's think about, are we doing 2 to 3 bouts of resistance training a week? That's our big rock. And then I still don't think we've got the evidence to say in that population, if we're going over 1.6 grams per kilo, are we going to see these added benefits if we're doing resistance training and we're getting high quality protein in? So I think that's just the area at the moment that's interesting. I think obviously it's different for our physique athletes, our what's the term, like our CrossFit athletes, where there's a big amount of resistance training and muscle reconditioning going on, which is a lot different than our more sedentary population, that we just want them exercising and getting into the gym would be great.
For sure. And I really like that you talked about the distribution, because I mean, no doubt, according to the research, total daily protein does play the biggest role for sure. But you mentioned satiety, and of course, satiation plays a huge role when it comes to adherence and just seeing the results that you want, whether that be weight loss or performance oriented. So, still making sure, even though it is about total daily protein, maybe not having any protein throughout the entire day and then eating 120 grams in your dinner, that is not optimal. Perhaps better than not getting enough all in all. But when it comes to particularly weight loss or something like that, trying that we can distribute it and have a satiated day that way.
Absolutely. And I think that's the message that gets lost around a lot of our population. The focus is commonly weight loss. And so that distribution is a key element there. And everyone's different. And I think there is only just, one paper would show that really high protein intake, and there needs to be a follow-up around that of one big bolus. But I do think it does show that if people are eating differently and they're resistance training and they're getting enough protein, then that's probably one of the big rocks. But I find for my patients that distribution is really important for satiety. And
For sure. Yeah, you also mentioned,
we can address this one.
sorry, you also mentioned quality. And on that point, of course, often it is said animal protein sources tend to be the most bioavailable, most easily absorbed, and generally gram for gram or per calorie anyway, highest in protein. Nonetheless, I would like to hear from you. What do you think of plant-based protein sources? And with that, also, let's throw into that category, what do you think of collagen as a protein source?
Good questions. I think the idea that animal protein is superior to plant has now been sort of challenged quite a lot. And I think Stu Phillips has shown some great work in that area, where I think if we're eating a balanced protein intake from plant proteins and we're reaching those protein intakes, then I think in combination with resistance training, then the bioavailability is just as superior. So I think you can get it different ways. I think the biggest thing for an athlete or a patient on a plant-based diet is just being planned and organized. So to reach those protein intakes takes a little bit more organization. There are a lot more readily available plant-based protein isolated sources now that can help with really high quality bioavailable protein. So I think when I work with a vegetarian or plant-based athlete, it's just often more awareness. And you might have a patient that's growing up in a plant-based household that has really good food preparation skills, or you might have a professional rugby player that's watched a documentary and has just taken animal protein off their plate. So those are the things we see, and they all require a different level of care. Collagen. So again, I think collagen is interesting in that more and more of the, I guess, the really well-controlled trials that are coming out are showing that the quality of collagen to impact muscle protein is very minimal. I think if anything, there may be a small role in connective tissue, but the more research that comes out, I'm just not convinced that it's a major. I think the biggest thing is if we're pr consuming enough protein, of high quality protein, that's the most important. Flooding the system with non-essential amino acids just doesn't seem to be shifting the dial so much, but there is still work, more work to be done. And I think hopefully in the next couple of years we will get a bit more information, but at the moment it's not looking too good, I would say.
Yeah, it is a bit of a shame because I think particularly amongst women, again, quite often being targeted from like marketing, et cetera, collagen also at the same time as it being a protein, it's going to also be good for your skin and blah, blah, blah. And so then thinking that that's maybe the only source to be supplementing with, et cetera, in order to get to their protein goal, it really is a false information. I think the majority of the research is really stating exactly what you're saying, that it is not being used for muscle protein synthesis. And I did see a paper just recently, the combination of collagen protein and whey protein isolate, and that had great results in terms of recovery for the connective tissue and the muscle tissue. And I can, like, I mean, that makes sense if you combine the two, being complementary when it comes to their amino acid profile sort of thing. But just taking a collagen protein supplement, like in the morning as your only protein source for that meal or so, is certainly not a great approach.
Absolutely. And I think the big thing is looking at the quality of the trial. So a lot of the work now that with protein, we want to sort of see tissue samples, we want to see incorporation in there. And being a researcher myself, it's hard when we look at how you feel and how you recover, because it's just so mixed. But I do think, yeah, and I mean, it's going to do no harm. It's a safe product to take. But unfortunately, what we often see is now patients taking collagen post-workout rather than your whey protein, your pea protein, that's got a high quality, or ideally a mixed meal. And we know that the essential amino acid content is non-existent, and it's not going to shift the dial on muscle protein synthesis. So I think it's just having an understanding that yes, maybe this is an intervention that may play a small role in skin and tissue health, but it's not the big rock. And you're not missing out. And we know, I think the great thing with the research has shown that the biggest thing that influences connective tissue is exercise. There
Absolutely.
are people that think, I'm not taking collagen, I'm not getting the best out of my rehab. And yeah, I think that we know that's not the case.
Absolutely. No, I think so many great points. And yeah, of course, I want to make sure I'm respecting your time, Dane, but I do want to talk about something I heard you in and heard you speak about in one of your chats, and that was the four R's of nutrition. I believe it was regenerate, rehydrate, refuel, and rest. Is that correct? Did I get that right?
So I guess when we talk to young athletes, we're trying to make things nice and simple, and the re is quite good. We talk about trying to get the body back to zero and train again, and all of those elements I think play a big part. And I mean, a lot of the time we see a lot of patients with low energy availability. This ultimately comes down a lot of the time if we take away the disordered eating to underfueling. And I think if we get our fueling practices right with protein, carbohydrate, distributing that well, fats, everything in our diet, then the risk of low energy availability is reduced. So that those are our big rocks, being proactive in our fueling and our education, and having patients and athletes aware of what they're doing and what that fueling looks like. So just one of our key findings in our research when we questioned our patients with REDS around the energy expenditure and what we estimated it was, 92% of them significantly underestimated their energy expenditure. So most people aren't aware of just how much energy they're expending. And a lot of that's probably to do with appetite changes and potentially some sort of disordered eating practices. But yeah, fueling the work that you're doing is really important.
Yeah, I mean, it is so easy. Let's say you're a recreational athlete, you have a full-time job, you are perhaps a parent as well, and like it's so easy to just get caught up in day-to-day life stuff and to, well, not forget about eating, but it's like I'll do that later. Or of course, when you're in that stressed state, you also don't want to shove in 1,000 calories in one sitting and then want to take a nap afterwards because you need your energy to keep going. And particularly if you add to that the desire to eat quote unquote clean. It is quite hard getting in, let's say, 3,000 calories. I'm sure for some of your athletes, especially if they're like endurance athletes, 3,000 calories is nothing. They might have to eat like 5,000 or 6,000 or whatever. If you just try to get that from potatoes, beans, maybe a little bit of chicken, good luck with that. You can blend that up and even then not really get that. But yeah.
And I think a lot of it comes back to your earlier point around satiety. So we know that fiber is really beneficial for the majority of the population, but excessive fiber can be a risk for low energy because it's just hard to consume that amount of energy when there's so much fiber in the diet. So it is being a little bit more conscious of the different types of foods that athletes are consuming. And just a lot of the time, it's giving them that freedom to liberalize a little bit and include, foods from social media that we might not deem as healthy, that be more, refined or concentrated in carbohydrate or glucose. But the energy turnover is so great that we've got room to include those, especially if, we do have those endurance athletes. So it's a constant work on as a practitioner around the messages that come from social media. There's some really good messages out there, some great people to follow, but there's also, there's always the other side of it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess one more question in regards to one of the R's, the rehydration. Do you generally advocate for just drinking according to thirst? Do you have a specific number that you want your athletes or your people to aim for? And also, would you like to see electrolytes included in that, or is just regular like salting your food enough?
So typically we know that thirst is a pretty good indicator for most people around their hydration needs. As you get into more longer duration exercise, that's when the argument of is thirst enough? Do we need a more planned approach? So a lot of athletes like to be planned. So there will be sort of certain protocols that we can do to get them to understand their sweat rate, start to trial with different fluid intakes. And what that looks like, because often there'll be an element of putting the carbohydrates together. So a plan will be needed in some regards. The electrolytes is an interesting one. I think the work that Alan McCubbin's doing out of Monash University is sort of getting us to think more critically around electrolytes. And I think electrolytes, again, is something that's becoming really popular on social media. But we know for our athletes, unless we're really tapping into probably that 3 to 5 hour range of exercise, that electrolyte replacement isn't probably that necessary. And provided we're eating, a good balanced diet, and we're going to get a lot of electrolytes from, whole foods. So that would be, there are certain athletes that they may use electrolyte supplementation for their long sessions. But we're also learning that our body regulates it really well. So again, it's something similar to collagen, as if you enjoy the taste of electrolytes, it's probably going to help you drink more, but you're not necessarily missing out physiologically if you're not having electrolytes and doing your 30 to 60 minutes aerobic exercise a day.
Yeah, I'm so glad you say that because I do think that it's again overused by marketing things and having to drink your $1 electrolyte drink every morning and then again with your training where it's like this is nothing but half a teaspoon of salt with a little bit of flavor. Okay, if you want to pay a dollar for that, sure, it'd be my guest, go for it.
And it's one of those things that's just, it's hard, isn't it, when you look at social media and you see these messages. But
Absolutely.
a great person to follow is Alan. He's doing some great work in electrolytes, and some there was an area that was neglected for a long time around sports nutrition, around electrolyte requirements. And that's created, I guess, a bit of a vacuum for people to come in and saying, you need this and that, based on some really old research. So it is an area now that we are seeing athletes become a lot more smart about, because too much electrolytes is a big cause of GI distress in ultra endurance athletes. So just taking huge amounts for training for your endurance event for the first time can get you into a bit of trouble sometimes.
Thank you for elaborating on that and just in general for all the wisdom you've shared with us today. And I guess just to round it off, to bring it back to the initial objective, you've given lots of practical tips for how to find out if perhaps you might be suffering from REDS or not. So if someone is determining, okay, I probably should be eating more, do you have one or two tips for them how to start, where to start?
Yeah, I guess it's a very hard thing to say, how much do I need to eat? What we've found, the easiest place to start, and you touched on this, is probably around the exercise. So I think start your, have your day with consistency, distribution, high quality main meals. If you're training more and those sessions are getting a bit more intense, think about fueling prior, especially if you're doing morning sessions. Does that session need additional fuel during? And maybe you need a little bit more in recovery than just a meal. That's a good place to start. And I think that, in addition to your main meals, and then you might just look into, maybe you change the carbohydrate availability on some of those days. So you're working with similar meals, but you might just increase the portion of your rice or your potato, or or your morning oats, that type of situation. So there's just different ways that, just having that awareness that if you eat the same thing every day, but you've got these big spikes in training volume, that we're going to need to have that adjustment. And just give it time. The body needs a bit of time to adjust. The reproductive hormones can take weeks to months to upregulate. And if you're unsure, see a sports dietitian, because they can help you do this and give you confidence of what you need. It's getting hard out there because there's so many bits of information that people get lost on, where sometimes just a good consultation can take all that stress away from you.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Dane. I'm going to make sure to put all your links, your contact details in the show notes. I'm really grateful for your time today and yeah, just generally for everything you've shared with us.
No worries. Yeah, great to have a chat.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dane. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow. And remember, if you want help with your nutrition and fitness goals, we'd love to guide you. One more thing before you go, if you're looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more, and feel free to use our code NCL for your chance to win a $250 gift card every month. Thank you for listening.